This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell.
Okay, once again, we are interviewing Aaron Glass, Executive Director of the Pacific Whale Watch Association, headquartered in Anacortes, Washington. PWWA is a community of ecotourism professionals with a shared commitment to education, conservation, and responsible wildlife viewing throughout Washington State and British Columbia. Aaron holds a BS in biology with marine emphasis from Western Washington University. She's been a passionate member of the whale watching community since 2008. Working as a whale-watching naturalist in both Southern California and the Salish Sea. Aaron is particularly interested in the region's baleen whale species, the minke whales, gray whales, and humpbacks. So, welcome, Aaron. Good to be talking to you again.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me back.
So, I'd like to just pick up where we left off last week. I wanted to ask you, we talked about orcas. I wanted to ask you about minke whales.
Oh, yeah, sure. Minke whales do not get the appreciation that they deserve. So happy to talk about that species.
So go ahead. What are the characteristics of minke whales, and why are you so interested in them?
Yeah, so they are a type of whale that folks usually don't pay much attention to, especially here in the Salish Sea. Most folks are so focused on killer whales or humpback whales or even gray whales, and minke whales swim under the radar, so to speak. As far as size goes, they're smaller than humpback whales or gray whales. Humpback whales and gray whales are about the size of a bus. They're about 40 to 50 feet long. Minke whales don't get quite that long. They're about 25 feet, I'd say. About the same size as a killer whale. But they are a baleen whale species, which means that they don't have teeth. Instead, they have baleen plates in their mouth, and they use those to filter feed on mostly little bait fish, things like sardines and anchovies. But they're quite shy. You know, we just don't see very many of them. And they're not an endangered species worldwide. There's quite a lot of them. But here in the Salish Sea, we only see a handful of them a year, and they usually stay all throughout the summer and fall. Only about a dozen or so each year make the Salish Sea home.
And orcas that we talked about last week, orcas, I understand, are actually dolphins. Are minke whales true whales?
So this is another spirited debate among the whale community here in the Pacific Northwest. You are correct. Killer whales, also known as orcas, are the largest of the dolphin family. But dolphins are a type of toothed whale. So killer whales are both dolphins and whales. So All dolphins are whales, but not all whales are dolphins. So minke whales, a baleen species, are a type of baleen whale, whereas killer whales are a type of toothed whale. Those are the two different groups of whales that we have. Toothed whales that have teeth, obviously, baleen whales, which don't.
And let's talk about white-sided dolphins then. Are white-sided dolphins, just talk about them. What kind of food absorption do they have?
Yeah, so Pacific white-sided dolphins, as you can probably guess, are a type of dolphin, which is a toothed whale or an odontocete. So they have teeth that they use to catch their prey. We really don't see a ton of them down here in Washington. They're found in much larger numbers up near Vancouver Island, the north end of Vancouver Island, up in the north Strait of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
But we do every now and then see them come down into Washington waters, even occasionally down into Puget Sound, but they seem to feed on small bait fish, again, things like sardines and anchovies, also squid. They'll eat squid when there's lots of squid in the area. They're a really cool-looking species, fantastic kind of black, white, and gray coloration. I wish we saw them more often, but we don't see them a ton down here in Washington waters.
And then, well, humpbacks. We have humpbacks in the Salish Sea.
We do. Humpbacks are another one of my favorite species, and we are very fortunate that we have record-breaking numbers of humpbacks here in Washington now. That was not the case a century ago. We almost lost them. Mm. Commercial whaling, like many species of whales, humpbacks are no exception, and commercial whaling almost entirely wiped out humpbacks, not just from Washington, but from the entire Pacific Ocean. There were no humpbacks left in Washington state's inland waters going back as far as, say, the early 1900s. But fortunately, whaling for humpback whales stopped in the 1960s. Over the decades, they've started to rebound in numbers, and as that population grows, they're looking for new places to feed. And luckily, one of those places is here in Washington, and so we've gone from having basically no humpback whales a century ago to the current numbers, which are, last year there were almost 400 different humpback whales photographed in Washington and BC waters last year alone.
And then gray whales are also found here in the Sound and Salish Sea.
Yeah, gray whales are another baleen species that we see here in Washington, especially in Puget Sound. That's actually kind of their hot spot. And for gray whales, we are a pit stop for them. So every year they make a very long migration from the Arctic up in Russia and Alaska all the way down to Baja California, Mexico. And then they'll typically stop here for a couple of weeks or months on their way back home. And while they're here, they're having a quick little snack of ghost shrimp. That's what they really love. Oh. And we have a lot of that in Puget Sound.
Mm-hmm. I've seen gray whales off of Point Reyes down in California. They make an annual circuit.
Yep, so same exact gray whales. They're just on a different part of their journey when you see them down there.
Right. While we're talking about whales, I wonder if you can say anything about whale intelligence. And how are they regarded in, I guess, a range of species and their ability to comprehend or understand or solve threats or problems?
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's such a great question, and I'm glad that you asked that one. So whales of all types are very intelligent, and some are even known to be more intelligent than others. Dolphins, for example, including killer whales, are thought to be among the most intelligent in the animal kingdom. It's, you know, probably a debate among all these different wildlife biologists of which animals are most intelligent, right? They're certainly, I would say, a top five near, you know, like the great apes and elephants, some of the higher level birds, for example, like parrots. These are all really intelligent animals, but dolphins are definitely up there. But some of the other whales, like humpback whales, gray whales, minke whales, they're not really given the credit that they're owed. And so maybe that's why I prefer baleen whales and teaching people about baleen whales, is because dolphins get a lot of credit for being smart, but baleen whales are also very, very intelligent. They've shown that they form these really lasting bonds. You know, you can call them friendships if you'd like. I do. But some of the whales, the gray whales and the humpback whales that we see coming to this area, come and associate with the same animals year after year after year for 30-plus years. They're not related to each other. They just seek out the company of these same individuals year after year. And so it just shows me that there's a lot more going on there than we understand.
Right. Okay, let's move on to porpoises. We have two species here in this area, the harbor porpoise and the Dalles porpoise.
We do, yeah. And just like humpback whales, harbor porpoise are undergoing a really fantastic conservation comeback. They used to be very plentiful here in Washington, especially Puget Sound. And then about 50 years ago, their numbers really plummeted. And we're not quite sure what led to those low numbers, but I'm happy to say that now in 2023, they've come back and they are once again the most abundant cetaceans that we see. There's a few theories. One is that back in 1972, there was an act that was put into place called the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which protected all marine mammals, so not just the large whales, but smaller cetaceans like porpoises, pinnipeds like seals and sea lions, even polar bears are under the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
Mm.
So that went into place in 1972, and that kind of changed some of the fishing regulations. You were no longer allowed to just, you know, accidentally catch a bunch of porpoises in your fishing nets and not have any consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably helped them quite a bit. We also learned a lot more about pollution, especially here in Puget Sound. So things have cleaned up considerably since then. So it's probably a multitude of factors, but yeah, we now see harbor porpoises quite often, including big groups of harbor porpoises, you know, 20, 50, sometimes even 100 or more in the same place. Now, Dahl's porpoise are a really cool species. They're one of the fastest cetaceans in the ocean. They're a striking black color with white highlights, but we tend to see them more in the big open waterways. So in the Juan de Fuca Strait, up in the Strait of Georgia, we don't see them make quite as many forays down into Puget Sound near Seattle. And it seems like as the number of harbor porpoise has increased, we've actually not been seeing as many Dahl's porpoise. So it could be that they compete for the same food, and as one population grew, maybe it kind of pushed Dahl's porpoises out. But if you have a chance to see Dahl's porpoise, and we usually do several times a year, it's a really cool species.
Do any of the operators, or do any of them themselves, or maybe even you, do any scuba diving to get down and see underwater what whale behavior is like?
Oh, so I think I mentioned in our talk last week that there's actually very strict laws here in Washington State about distances that you have to stay from whales. And so you are not allowed to swim intentionally with any of our whale species here in Washington State. But we have really cold water and the visibility is not all that great anyway. So I wouldn't recommend you try, even if it was legal. But, yeah, we don't do any diving with the whales just because there are those really strict regulations in place.
And if you're doing research, you can't get an exception to that?
If you are doing research under permit, you can apply for a permit in order to be able to get a little bit closer. Also, that applies to drones. So, for example, we are not allowed to fly drones over whales. But researchers can, and so they can apply for research permits to be able to do that. But, yeah, as whale watch operators, we do not qualify for those types of exemptions.
Okay, on to pinnipeds.
Okay.
What do we got, harbor seals, lions?
Yeah, so here in Washington, we kind of have four main pinniped species. Every now and then a different one will sneak in, but we've got kind of four, and going in order of size, those are going to be harbor seals, California sea lions, Steller sea lions, all the way up to northern elephant seals. Harbor seals are the smallest. They're only about, you know, 200, 250 pounds, but they are very numerous. They're probably the most abundant pinnipeds that we have here in Washington State. I mentioned those culls when we used to hunt seals and sea lions prior to 1960. We almost got rid of harbor seals in this area, but since they've been protected, their populations has rebounded, which is great news for us because it's lured those mammal-eating killer whales, the Biggs killer whales, into the area. So now we see a lot more Biggs killer whales here because they have seals to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on up, we have the California sea lions. Same exact idea. Even though their name is the California sea lion, this is part of their range. You can actually find them all the way up even farther north than Washington.
Mm.
They're a bit larger. A really big male might weigh about 800 pounds. These are kind of a dark chocolatey brown color. You see them around Puget Sound on docks a lot of times. And then moving up, we have the Steller sea lions, which put California sea lions to shame as far as size goes. A large male Steller sea lion gets to be about 2,500 pounds. They're huge, but they're a little bit lighter brown in color. So if you ever see two sea lions next to each other, and you're not sure which one is a California and which one's a Stellar's. The Stellar's is going to be much larger as well as lighter in color. And they are the ones that are a little bit more north in range. So you'll find them all the way up into Alaska. And then the biggest pinnipeds that we have here in Washington, and they're actually the biggest pinnipeds in all of the northern hemisphere, are the northern elephant seals. Northern elephant seals have an incredible, incredible recovery story. You know, humans, 100, 150 years ago, when we were trying to teach others about all these unusual species around the world, the way that we did that was kill them and stuff them and put them in a museum, right? And so in addition to being hunted for their blubber, which you could render down and make oil, elephant seals, the last ones that were remaining, were actually shot so that they could be put on display in museums. And they thought that elephant seals had been totally wiped out, but they ended up finding a small colony of less than 50 elephant seals. And it is from those 50 that the 100 plus thousand elephant seals that we have today all originated. So luckily, we did not wipe them out, and they're a really cool species. We don't see a ton of them here in Washington, but I'd say we have about a dozen or so.
And the difference between seals and sea lions is that sea lions have four legs, and seals have a fused have fused legs in back. Is that right?
So they both have four flippers. So you have two flippers in front, two flippers in back.
Yeah.
But seals have very short front flippers. They kind of just have to waddle around on land,
right,
whereas sea lions have very long front flippers. So they can actually kind of run on land very effectively.
Right.
As you mentioned, you've got it right. So seals have fused hip bones. So again, they're just not very mobile, whereas sea lions do have a lot more range of motion. And then the biggest difference is actually their ears. So the seals, what we call true seals, do not have an external ear flap. If you look at the side of their head, they just have a tiny little pinhole that is their ear. Whereas sea lions have an external ear flap that you can see sticking out on the side of their head.
Okay, how about otters? Sea otters and river otters. And
yeah.
River otters, I understand, invade the sea.
Yes, so sea otters are a type of otter that we do not see very often, but in the last several years, we've been seeing an increase number here in these inland waters. They're usually, as you mentioned, kind of more out in the open ocean, so out on the outer coast of Washington, out near Cape Flattery, for example. But, you know, as those populations grow, every now and then we'll see a few, you know, kind of intrepid explorer otters come in and explore this area. And I'd say we probably have at least about half a dozen sea otters that are inhabiting the Salish Sea. It is still a really rare sighting, though, and so we as the Pacific Whale Watch Association keep track of all of that information, and we share those sightings with researchers just because it is more unusual. River otters, however, are very common, and a lot of times river otters are mistaken for sea otters, but they look quite different. River otters are much smaller,
right,
a lot more slender. They have a long tail, and the biggest difference is that they run around on land, so the sea otters spend most of their time in the water, but river otters are the ones that'll, you know, get into quite a lot of mischief, crawling around on docks and beaches, you know, making a mess. A lot of people that have marinas don't like them because they'll wake up and see a bunch of, you know, clam shells and crab shells on their boats. But those are probably coming from river otters, which we do have quite a lot of. And even though their name is river otter, yes, they do live out in salt water as well.
And on the tours, what kind of birds are they, marine birds are they likely to see?
Yeah, so we have nearly 200 different species of birds that live in and around the Salish Sea. We don't see a lot of pelagic birds like you would if you were, say, you know, 20 miles off the coast of Washington, those big albatross and shearwaters. We don't get a lot of those,
yeah.
But I would say the two types of birds that we get the most requests for here in our inland Washington waters are bald eagles, of course. Even though we see them quite a bit living here, a lot of folks who are visiting from out of town really want to see that iconic bald eagle. And then also puffins, tufted puffins are a really cool bird that we see here mostly in the summertime. They're actually an endangered species in Washington state specifically. Their numbers are declining in Washington, and we're not quite sure why that is. And so another research project that the PWWA participates in, just like with our cetaceans, is reporting sightings of tufted puffins and keeping track of that to share with WDFW wildlife officers.
I've seen them in Alaska, but I didn't know they came this far south.
Yeah, not a ton, but we have, I'd say, about 20, maybe 30 breeding pairs. There's very few places that you can see them, but Smith Island, which is off of Whidbey Island in the Juan de Fuca Straits, just south of the San Juan Islands, that's where we see them the most. And like I said, there's probably, I'd say, about 20 or so breeding pairs there on Smith Island. So some of our whale watch operators actually, during those summer months, offer tours specifically to go see puffins. So not even a whale watch trip. They just go out with the intent of finding those puffins and crossing it off for those serious birders' life lists.
All right. So what do the operators do about trash that they find? Do they collect it? Do they try to remove it?
So we try to collect debris anytime that we can, but unfortunately there's a lot more trash out there than we could physically collect. We collect debris as part of what we call our Sentinel Actions Program. So we keep track each year of how many balloons and plastic bottles and bags and things like that we actually pull out of the ocean. And over the years, gosh, it's, you know, thousands of balloons, for example, that we've pulled out. So one of the things we're really trying to push is just education about how harmful balloons can be, because when they're floating in the water, they kind of resemble, you know, a fish or a jelly, for example. And so animals will eat them thinking that they're food, and then that can actually end up being fatal. So, yeah, balloons are just bad. We'll also collect derelict fishing gear, so things like ropes or nets that have been discarded or lost. Those are a huge entanglement risk to wildlife. So, yes, if we can, even during the course of a regular whale-watching tour, we'll stop and try to retrieve those items. But, yeah, unfortunately, we cannot get it all.
Are there other operations that actually go out and try to collect trash that they find in the water?
You know, I'm not sure about trash. So, you know, things like plastic and balloons, I'm not sure about that. There are some dedicated campaigns here in Washington that are aimed toward going out and getting that derelict fishing gear. So if you see a crab pot, for example, that looks like it's been out there for a while, you know, maybe it has a bunch of algae growing on it and things like that, you can, you know, contact WDFW and report those, and they'll go out and retrieve things like that. So for fishing gear, there are a few projects that are working to remove that. But as far as just general trash, there's nothing that I'm aware of specifically. Now, once that trash washes up, there's lots of different groups throughout Puget Sound and Washington State that do beach cleanups. So you can probably find a beach cleanup near you. There's a really great website called whalescout.org that will show you on a map where all these little beach cleanups or tree plantings or cool projects like that are happening so that you can participate. But when it's still out there in the water, I'm not sure if there's any programs that are specifically out there looking for it.
How important is bull kelp for marine life, and how essential is it, and how common is it, and is it on the decline or stable?
Oh, yeah. So bull kelp it kind of looks like a plant. So if you happen to see bull kelp, it looks like a plant. It looks like it has a stem with leaves, but it's actually an algae. So it doesn't have roots. It actually just grows and collects all of its nutrients by absorbing them from the water. But just like trees on land in a forest, bull kelp and other types of kelp that are in the water are really essential as part of the underwater forest, those kelp forests.
Right.
And so you have this kelp that grows, you know, 100 feet tall, and it acts as a food source for some animals. It acts as shelter, so, you know, little baby fish can hide in among the kelp and grow. But yeah, like I said, just like a forest, it serves the same purpose underwater, producing oxygen, an important part. But sadly, here in Washington, especially in Puget Sound, bull kelp is on the decline. I think that I read recently that we lost about 80% of our bull kelp coverage since the peak, you know, many decades ago, which is just so upsetting. So they're not 100% sure why, but we do theorize that it's probably in part due to rising ocean temperatures, unfortunately, as well as possibly chemical pollution. But there are some initiatives right now underway to both go out and actually protect bull kelp, so make sure that the places where we still have healthy populations of bull kelp, that those are protected. And then also there's discussion about possibly farming and reintroducing kelp to places where it used to be historically and may have died off. So just like, again, planting trees on land, seeing if you can transplant bull kelp to places where it's needed.
Well, Aaron, once again, we've used up another half hour, and I really appreciate it. This has been incredibly informative, and I much appreciate your being able to do this. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure. Yeah, the Salish Sea is such an incredible ecosystem, and we are very, very lucky to live here. So thanks for letting me talk about it.
Our guest today has been Aaron Glass, Executive Director of the Pacific Whale Watch Association, that's headquartered in Anacortes, Washington. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.